chapter 12. I'll read. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach and you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain, when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they are few and those looking through the windows grow dim, when the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades, when men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint, when men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and desire is no longer stirred, then man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed, or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring, or the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. Not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails, given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil.
Well, all kinds of odd things have been discovered on the West Coast beaches in the United States, including a Harley Davidson, which has just been found washed up on the beach. With six golf clubs stuck underneath it. It is amongst a whole load of debris from the Japanese tsunami from March 2001. It's been washed across the Pacific Ocean for 4,500 miles, and now it is arriving on the beach. There's already apparently 1.5 million tons of debris that has arrived, including a roof from a house, a fridge, a VCR collection of 1970s movies, an entire waterside concrete dock, and a Harley Davidson, and tons more is on its way, and we'll be arriving there for the next few years. But imagine that you are kind of innocent to all of that, walking along the beach with your dog or whatever, and suddenly you come across the rusted, beaten-up motorbike. The obvious question is, how on earth did this get here? It's a Harley Davidson. Why would you put it on the beach? That's exactly where we're going to begin now. We got to the end of our first session saying, everything is outside the garden, everything is messed up. The question is, how on earth did it get like this? Why is it like that? And that's what we're going to think about this morning. We're going to begin by keep a finger in Ecclesiastes 12 and come to Romans chapter 8 with me. Romans chapter 8 and verse 18 on its page 1135. And I want to read these words to us. Romans 8, verse 18. I consider that our present sufferings... Oh, wait a minute, sorry, just hear the pages. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay, and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly, as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. But hope that is seen is not hope at all. Who hopes for what he has already has? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. Now, I just want you to see a few of the phrases that I read there. So, looking back, We're told, aren't we, verse 19, that all creation is, verse 20, subjected to frustration. That it is, verse 21, in bondage to decay. That it is groaning, verse 22, all creation. Now, who'd have thought that all creation would be in bondage to decay just because Adam and Eve ate an apple? Well, of course, it wasn't just eating an apple. It was shaking a fist, defiantly walking away, slamming a door in God's face. Sin is far wider in its effects than perhaps we think it ought to be. It affects all creation, we're told here. Think of dust and the way that dust covers everything. You know, always amazing when you come to do a spring clean, you know, once every 28 years or whatever, and you discover dust in the most hidden away places, don't you? You move a whole load of books or whatever, and you discover dust has got down behind the back of the books, along the back of the book. How did it get into that tiniest of gap? It does just coat everything. And sin's effect in our world is like that. It's a thick covering of muck that gets in everywhere. It's a bit like those, you know, we see those pictures on the news at the moment of floods and all of that kind of disgusting brown water being swished out of house front doors, and then that sludge that is left. It's that same idea. Nothing remains unaffected. Everything is coated with it. There's a 1970s Christian book called The Dust of Death. That is a very suggestive title, isn't it? The dust of death. Death that covers everything, coats it all. Yesterday, in my rush to prepare for today, and I was falling behind with various deadlines, I was a bit grumpy because I was tense about getting everything done, and I was a bit short with my wife, Lizzie, some question she asked me, a sort of slightly snappy kind of answer. And I knew as soon as I'd said it that I'd made her cross inside, but I was short of time. I hadn't got time to say sorry and go and sort it out. I just, well, whatever. I heard her then go out and shout at our teenage son. She was frustrated with me, but it came out at him. She was just short-tempered with him. I knew it was really because she was a bit cross with me. Anyway, that led him to go upstairs, loads of noise going up the stairs, stomping along the corridor, slamming his bedroom door shut. Now, his bedroom door has got two glass panels in it. And as he slammed the door, one of those panes of glass smashed with the impact. Just behind him was my 11-year-old daughter, Maisie, and just as she got there, the glass smashed, and a tiny slither of glass ended up in her eye last night. So we had to go along to the hospital, A&E, and we ended up sitting there for ages last night, which is why I look so bleary-eyed this morning, because there was an emergency operation last night, and we thought at one point that she was going to lose her sight in that eye just because of this tiny bit of glass. And the whole thing happened because of my silly grumpiness. You know, the effects travelled on a line, along a line, more and more people got affected by it, including innocent bystanders, almost at random where the consequences were felt. You know, my poor Maisie nearly lost her sight in one eye because of how I'd been. Now, I guess that's not a kind of unfamiliar story. Now, let me just say that none of that story was in fact true. I just made it all up for effect. but you get the point. So all those people going, joke. Sin is far wider in its effects than we think it ought to be, as that story just proved. And the consequence for Adam and Eve is the world as it is. Thorns and thistles, earthquakes and cancer, hurt and hankies. All of that spoiling love and laughter. The suffering, the pain, the death that we all know, the meaninglessness that we all know, that marks all of life now we're outside the garden. Now, I've got two simple questions to ask as we look at this passage before we go back to Ecclesiastes. The first question is this: who? Who made the world to be like this, so it is all subject to frustration and to decay? Answer: God did it. The world is as it is. Creation is subjected to futility, to frustration, verse 20, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope. Now, that has to be God. The only other candidates are Adam and Eve and the devil, but neither of them would subject it with hope in mind. So it has to be God. It's God who made things crooked like this. Now, it may be that our first kind of knee-jerk reaction when I say that, and faced with human suffering, is to distance God from it, to say, oh, no, I'm sure it couldn't be him. He wouldn't have anything to do with something as horrible as that. But we mustn't be like that. Only he and he alone could subject the world to frustration in hope. He was personally involved. He did it. Not just watching on while this led to that consequence, but far more active than that. God looked at human sin and he said, here's my response to that. Now, what that tells us is that sin is no small thing. He hates it this much. It must be really, really offensive to him, mustn't it? It must be far more terrible than we might imagine if God says it makes him this angry, that this is an appropriate response. All of those things we were thinking about before coffee are part of his response, making the world like this. And every time we hear news of another flood or we watch footage of third world malnourished babies on the point of death or whatever, we're seeing that on the screen. We ought not just to do what my parents did, and which I've discovered as I get older I do, which is to kind of tut at the news and say how terrible that is. What we must also be saying is how awful our sin is. That led to that. That God has handed us over to that. He's painted the world in those kind of colours to show us how ugly, how outrageous, how hideous is my sin. So he's teaching me about my sinful heart. Now, if you're not a Christian here today, you'll be thinking, I don't think stuff I do is that bad. It is. It is that bad in God's eyes. So who did it? God made the world to be like that. And that leads to the second question. Why? Why on earth did God do it? Why would he give us all the agonizing heartaches of this world in response to what Adam and Eve did? An overreaction, we might feel. Let's just be clear that what happened at this cosmic level is not just because of my personal sin. So if something bad happens in my life, it is not God got it in for me because of the particular thing I did. I did something wrong, so God is zapping me. It's not just about me and my sin. It's not just about all the sins I committed yesterday. It's not even my lifetime of sin. The reason that we're given to explain why God did it in verse 20 is that he did it in hope. So the whole of creation, the whole world, every part of our lives is groaning under the weight of the fall as it hopes for the ending of that decay. And Christians as well, we're groaning as we hope for, verse 25, what we do not yet see. As a Christian, I'm looking forward to all that heaven will give to me. I'm waiting for the new world. I'm longing for that eternity, but I ain't got it yet. What Christ won in the cross for us is kept in heaven for us, according to 1 Peter. Christianity, if you like, is like an iceberg religion. 99% of it remains hidden. We don't see it yet. That's what verses 25 and 26 say, isn't it? Sorry, 24 and 25 say. We don't yet see it, all that Jesus won for us. I'm up here with my phone because I'm waiting my third grandchild. So labour began yesterday at 3 a.m. And my son and his partner spent the day hanging around. I just, as the Bible reading was going, had two messages. One saying, still going, dot, dot, dot. Then one 3 minutes later saying, all okay, but not there yet. As if 9 months haven't been enough. Getting ready, decorating the room, Lottie stopping work and so on. They've been waiting. And now they spent the last, whatever it is, 24, 30 hours or something, waiting, walking hospital corridors, and some of you can perhaps remember those wee hours of the night, waiting, 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 walking hospital corridors for it to happen. By the way, that isn't a made-up story, just for effect, that one is true. Now, that is hope in the Bible. Not what we tend to mean by the word, sort of wishful thinking, but the combination of confidence and waiting. Sure it's coming, and waiting for it to come. Looking forward to something like a woman in labour who can't wait for her baby to come out, as I'm sure is exactly what Lottie is feeling at the moment. Waiting is painful, but the painful birth pangs say it is coming for sure. Confidence and waiting. And what Paul says in these verses is that waiting for that, that resolution of all ills, whilst we groan in a meaningless world, that is worth it. It's going to be worth it at the end. How could it ever be true? How could I ever say, verse 18, I consider our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed? How could I ever say that about the sufferings of this present age? If you've personally felt what we're on about here, you know, you've been at the sharp end of it, the sharp end of the bondage to decay, how can I ever say that? And I don't think that means we'll ever say, oh, the suffering didn't hurt. Of course it hurts. But one day we will say, from the perspective of the new heaven and the new earth, however awful our experiences of life now, whether generally or specific incidences, we won't be thinking about it then. It'll just be like a new mum with her newborn infant. Isn't that striking whenever you go and see somebody with a new baby? You know, she forgets the extreme agony of her extended labour because of the joy she cradles in her arms. You say to her, was it worth it? She's going to say, oh, forget all that now. Just look at my lovely Zebedee Tom, or whatever he's called. Now, that is what Ecclesiastes describes. That time from fall to liberation is groaning. Every part of creation is not now as it should be. And it is not how it will be after that end time. So I think that in Ecclesiastes, when it's saying everything is meaningless, in a way what it's saying is everything is fallen. It's all affected. It's all messed up. It's all got the dust of death lying thick over it. Now let me just pause on that before we go back to Ecclesiastes 12. And let me ask you what you expect your life to feel like. Especially if you're a Christian. Groaning. That's what Romans 8 says it should feel like. Very different, isn't it, from how Christianity is usually presented today. Become a Christian and groan. And it's not the normal evangelistic appeal, is it? A few years ago, a friend of mine was at a Christian town-wide youth rally. And the message from the front, he said, went something like this. Do you realize how much Jesus wants to help you? He wants to pour out his amazing love on us all. With Jesus, life will be easier and all our problems will disappear. See, in that kind of message, what we're being told is that basically, if you're a Christian, it's simply not necessary to feel the impact of things like family tensions, disappointments, frightening possibilities, discouraging news. There's a kind of an inexpressible joy that is available that will not just support us through hard times, but will eliminate the hard times themselves. Life is going to have its rough spots, but it's said, you know, the reality of Christ's presence will so thrill our souls that pain is virtually unfelt. I mean, if you doubt it, just listen to the God Channel, churning that message out the whole time. And to make matters worse, I think in our church lives, a church life, we very often appear to reward those whose lives appear intact. Just think about who we get to give a testimony, to come and tell us the story of how they became a Christian or how life is. Generally, testimonies go along this line, my life was bad, my life is better. Generally, don't they? That's what we parade in front of people. And so what we do by that is, maybe not explicitly, but by impression, we blunt the reality, the painful reality of what it's like to live outside the garden, to live as part of an imperfect community, to live in a fallen world where everything is meaningless. And as you go on in the Christian life, you learn to pretend because you join in with the game. We learn to pretend that we're feeling now what actually we won't feel to heaven. And then when some crisis comes, Christian people start to feel, what's wrong with me? I don't feel like I think I'm supposed to feel and like everybody else feels. That friend I mentioned who went to that youth rally, he wrote to me afterwards. I imagined a horde of happy teenagers leaving that event having been caressed by a false Jesus who would suddenly reject Christ as soon as any trouble came their way. It really was the worst sort of man-centered evangelism, pernicious and heartless. Because the reality, see, the truth, Romans 8, is groaning. There is an ache that will not go away, and for very good reason. We were designed for a world that is better than this. And until we are in that world, we will groan. We will long for it. So until then, we will either groan or we will pretend we don't. Let me just say that again. Until then, we will either groan or pretend we don't. I remember once preaching through Ecclesiastes, and one particular Sunday I stood up to preach and I saw There was a lady in there who I knew was going through a really, really difficult time. She was suffering from depression. And I thought, brilliant, she's managed to make it to church because she hasn't been for ages. And I thought, oh my goodness, Ecclesiastes, that's the last thing she needs. If only my sermon today was one of those nice, touchy-feely, warm, encouraging sermons about how much God loves us and is with her and all of that. Anyway, I preached through what I prepared and tried all the way through the sermon not to look at her over there all the way through. And not to catch her eye. And then at the end, she came up to me and she said, thank you so much for Ecclesiastes. And I said, well, I didn't write it, but you know what I mean. It is so encouraging for me to know that that book is in the Bible because it makes sense of what I'm feeling. And all of that kind of, if you like, prosperity light version of Christianity just doesn't make sense of it for her. She's going to be saying all the way through, why am I not feeling what I'm supposed to feel? Ecclesiastes explains it to her. You are feeling as you are feeling because everything is fallen. Everything is affected by the fall. You see, life is not like the kind of Forrest Gump thing, you know, my life is like a box of chocolates, etc. It's much more like a bit of IKEA furniture. Here is a very up-to-date illustration because IKEA on Monday is celebrating the 25th anniversary of the opening of the first shop in the UK. And I guess we all know what it's like trying to build with IKEA furniture, isn't it? You know, there's always the bit at the end that doesn't seem to fit, the drawers that don't run like they're supposed to, the back panel that bulges or whatever. And that despairing comment, you know, there must be something wrong with these instructions, you know. And no doubt in such moments you've met the armchair expert, she's called your wife, who has her own suggestions of what you should have done. And failing all else, you know, smash it with a hammer, that'll fix it. Now that is how Ecclesiastes sees the world, like a half-made bit of IKEA furniture. Let's turn back to Ecclesiastes. See, as I look round at the world, what is it that I see? I see drawers that aren't even nearly square. I see shelves that don't fit. I see the bit that seems to be missing. And I find myself asking, have I got the instructions upside down? It's all topsy-turvy. Things don't work out. There are many armchair experts who just sit around looking at the world saying, well, this is what you need to do. Smash it with a hammer, shouts the punk. Well, we're going to go to the last chapter of the book, not to listen to yet another armchair expert, but to listen to the teacher, the collector, the preacher, somebody with real insight and perspective. And right at the end, verse 13, chapter 12, verse 13, you'll see he gets to what he calls the conclusion of the matter. This is his parting shot, if you like. How should we respond in a world like this? Three things to say, and you'll see the outline on the sheet in the books. First of all, verses 1 to 8, remember your Creator. You'll see that phrase comes in verse 1. And that really is the theme for those first seven verses. Remember your Creator. Remember him, first of all, in verses 1 to 5, before you are too old. Somebody was telling me that they visit a health food store where there was a book on the shelves entitled How to Avoid Aging. I suppose the advice of the book would be die young. I don't think that's what the book said. You know, we can experiment with the world's best lifting creams and firming lotions. Those names are vaguely grotesque, aren't they? And at best what they do, as the cream next to my bed says, is they reduce the appearance of aging. The truth is, chronology is against us. And the picture here in these verses is something like this. Think about a house that is falling into ruin. We've got one in our road, actually, that is falling into ruin. And these verses are saying that is a bit like the aging process. That's what the preacher is saying here. So verse 3, the keepers of the house tremble, just like an old person's arms do. The strong men stoop. Their legs bow and bend, the back bends over. The grinders cease because they are few. Is this referring to our teeth and how we have less as we get older? Those looking through the windows grow dim, just as eyes grow dim. Second half of verse 4, when men rise up at the sound of birds, but their songs grow faint. They're woken up by something, but they can't hear anything because they're hearing's going. I mean, it may be a bit fanciful to see that every bit of a house is like a person, but the point is, as verse 1 says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. My dad died about 4 years ago. He was 94 when he died. And over the last few years of his life, I watched him change from old to elderly to frail. And every time I went to see him, he was noticeably deteriorating. There would always be the next bit of his body that had stopped working. So he couldn't sit long for long without pain. Then he couldn't stay awake. He just fell asleep in the middle of a conversation. Then he couldn't hear properly. And then he couldn't see properly either. And then speech became a huge effort. And then in the last few days, even breathing took all he had, really. It was all he could do just to take the next breath. And then eventually even that became too much, and he stopped. And somewhere, sometime during that decline, I don't know, I could say exactly when, but it did become true that he got to the stage where there was no pleasure left for him in life. And he was ready to die. He was ready to go home. His body wore out. And what the teacher says is, remember him before you get to that stage. And remember him, secondly, verses 6 and 7, before you die. And the picture here, if you look down to verse 6, is think of a golden bowl that is held up by a fine silver chain. You just need one little link in that chain to break, don't you? And the golden bowl will fall and is broken, a bit like a necklace, perhaps, with a very fine chain and something on the end that would fall off. Or second picture in verse 6, think of a pottery jug that you use at a well to collect water. You only need the wheel on the well to break, and the pitcher will fall and be shattered. And so, inevitably, we will go down. As sure as gravity, we will return to dust. Verse 7. One of my things that I love doing is wandering around secondhand bookshops. And you often, in secondhand bookshops, come across books by Norman Vincent Peale. I don't know whether you know books by him. They've got titles such as Positive Thoughts for the Day, and so on. Here is Norman Vincent Peale's Positive Thought for the 30th of September. He's describing some occasion when he walked past a tree creaking in a rough storm. So you can remember this tomorrow, 30th of December. This is his positive thought. So he walks past this tree. He thinks, maybe it's going to come down. Don't worry, the tree seemed to say. I was here before you and I'll be here after you've gone. Oh, trees do go sometimes, but then what happens? A little shoot comes up and a new tree is started. Human beings are the same breed. They are absolutely undefeatable when they know they are, but they've got to know it. Now, maybe Mr. Peale is just being ridiculously optimistic. Or he was being. He's dead now. So it turns out, actually, that he wasn't absolutely undefeatable, even though he thought he was. There is a desperate unreality in that kind of self-pretense, isn't there? No, just like a tree and a little shoot will come. No, actually. The truth is, verse 7, the dust returns to the earth, and the spirit returns to the God who gave it. I mentioned in the first session that I love the writing of Samuel Beckett, and there's a bit in one of his plays where he speaks about life in this way. He says, they give birth astride a grave. The light gleams an instant, and then it's night once more. So his picture is of a mother standing like that over the grave, giving birth, and the baby dropping straight into the ground. And your life is that brief bit of light on the way from the womb to the grave, that millisecond. Now compare that with how God is described in verse 1. You see, the one we are to remember is described as creator, that is, life giver. So get this dramatic picture in verses 1 to 7. On the one hand, you've got deterioration and death. And on the other hand, you've got creation. The beginning of life, the end of life. So in other words, as well as the patently obvious truth that I am deteriorating, there is an alternative truth, and that is verse 1, that I am made. So there's what I see every day as I look in the mirror. It is painfully obvious I am deteriorating rapidly. But there is another truth that I don't see, but it's no less true. And the teacher is telling me about that. That in this meaningless world, in this fallen world, in a world that's covered with the dust of death, God is there and we're made by him. And that's to be no less influential on our opinions, our thoughts, than the bell that tolls. Remember your Creator. Second thing, verses 9 to 12, listen to your shepherd. And what we've got in these verses is something about how Ecclesiastes came to be written down for us and why. And we're told that the teacher in verse 9 pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. He searched to find just the right words or words of delight in another translation. And what he wrote were, the words he wrote were upright and true. Now, do you see that that is very similar to the way that, think of how Luke starts his gospel. Do you remember he says that he did a lot of careful research and selection of the stories about Jesus? That's exactly the same here. That's what the teacher is saying here, that he did. But where did they get those words from? And what we're told in verse 11 is that ultimately they come from the shepherd, which could be a title for the king, but more probably means the source of wisdom, God himself. So what you've got there is, in those few verses, is our doctrine of Scripture. Men spoke. They did research, collecting, selecting. From God. God was the one who gave them the words, ultimately. So that is why verse 11, we're told that what we read here are like nails, firmly embedded nails that are given by God. They're something to hang your coat on, if you like. It's to him, the shepherd, that we listen to. And the purpose of these words, verse 11, they are there to prod us, just as a stick with a sharp point prods cattle or sheep or whatever. But to say all that doesn't quite say why these words come here. What are verses 9 to 12 doing at the end of Ecclesiastes? I mean, presumably it's a bit more than the blurb you get on the back of a paperback. You know, this book is very worth reading. So-and-so says so. And I wonder if verse 12 is the key. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them, of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now, notice the contrast. You've got here somebody relentlessly searching for the latest idea. Writing a book, reading a book. They've got to get the latest book, the latest novel, whatever it is. The academic world is exactly as this verse implies, isn't it? Somebody comes up with a theory and writes the theory up. Then somebody else writes a review of that theory that's been written up. And then somebody else writes a reply to the theory that's been written up. Then those two articles, the original theory and the reply, get published in a book of essays. And then somebody writes a new PhD to challenge the debate of the things that are included in the essays. When I was at college, somebody told me how somebody had written, an academic theologian had written a spoof article once. He'd been asked to contribute to a theological dictionary, a definition of the Nephilim. Now, the Nephilim is something that appears in Genesis 6. Various translations treat it differently way, but there's something like big people who inappropriately are marrying people. You don't need to know anything more about it other than that. So anyway, he wrote this spoof people about the Nephilim. And in this article basically said the Nephilim are still around today. There's a sect in America called the Nephilites, who are a slightly odd Christian sect. The people walk around on stilts. Anyway, this article got published in this dictionary. Imagine his delight when he saw his spoof article on the Nephilim cited in a footnote in an academic article as shown in the article about Nephilim in blah, 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 blah. Which all goes to show, don't read a thing you read in books. There are so many books in the world, aren't there? And when the last of the Harry Potter novels was published, W.H. Smith was selling 15 copies every second. And it's just as true in church life. As a church minister, I have all this pressure. I've got to keep up with the latest idea. So I've got on my bookshelves The Purpose-Driven Church, a book called The Provocative Church, The Contagious Church, The Deliberate Church, and just in case any of them have forgotten anything, one called The Total Church. When I was being trained as a church worker, my mentor made me promise that I would never write a book. He said, don't ever write a book. There are plenty out there. Let's just read the ones.